once more under the breach, dear friends. Else fill up the wall with our English dead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and not Jake McClure. Jake is not feeling well. Something about being attacked by a virus and being under the influence of the cold, which is what influenza means. And we're hoping he will soon get better. I want to echo what was said in the news for those of you who are listening to the news, and get your flu shot if you haven't already gotten it. It isn't 100%. There's no guarantees. It's kind of like investing. There's no guarantees that you won't get the flu if you get the flu shot, but you will have a lower probability of getting the flu. And better yet, if you get the flu, it may not be as severe. So I would strongly recommend you get it, because it is definitely going around. Well, this is The Personal Wealth Coach, and The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission, which approves or disapproves anything we're doing. They're just our regulators. And let's see, I've got to tell you several other things here, too. What we're providing on this radio program is not investment advice, despite the fact we're a registered investment advisory firm, independent registered investment advisory firm. We provide educational information on this radio program, and we get that information from sources we believe to be reliable, things like the Financial Times of London and the Wall Street Journal and the federal government. And we believe they are reliable, and if they're not, we correct that later. But we don't make any guarantee or warranty as to the completeness or accuracy of what we're saying, because we're just not smart enough to do that. We also need to let you know that we don't pay for this radio program, and they don't pay us to be on the radio program. They pay the engineer in here, who is busily engineering. And although I've questioned him on several occasions, and he doesn't seem to have a train, so my grandchildren don't understand how he could be an engineer. We do advertise on KTEM. We don't advertise for our firm. We do advertise for the radio program, which sounds like a lot of disclosure, but that's the effect of being regulated. Telephone number in here, presuming that today where you are is the 30th day of November, the official end of November. Today, folks, is the end of 2019 November. Just remember that. This is the end. And if it is the 30th of November where you are, then you're welcome to give us a call in here, or give me a call. Yeah, I guess it's still us, technically. 254-773-1400. And jar my brain. I'm going to be in the position of awkwardly talking to a yellow foam ball for the next 2 hours unless somebody gives me a call. So, again, 773-1400, area code's 254-773-1400 if you want to give us a call. Well, the markets had a short week this week. In relatively low volume and relatively calm trading, because an awful lot of traders took the week off, apparently, or took most of the week off. But and it peaked on the day before Thanksgiving at 31.54, which, had it just stayed there, it would have been another record. I mean, it's been breaking records week after week after week, but it didn't stay there. On Friday, it got a little bit overstuffed and sagged back to 31.40.98, basically 31.41. But that is a 1.21% gain for the week, which doesn't sound like a lot. What's a 1.21% gain? Multiply that times 52 and you get some idea how fast the market is rising here at the end of the year. But to put that in a little bit of perspective, over the last month, it's up 3.4%, and it's up 7.4% for the trailing 3 months. In other words, in the last 3 months, the S&P 500 stock index has risen as much as historically it rises in a year on average. If you go back all the way to the beginning of the century, beginning of the 20th century, you get about a 7% rise per year, a little more than a 7% rise per year on average in the S&P 500 and its predecessors. And we've done that in the last 3 months, which is pretty impressive, until you think about it a little bit. However, putting it in perspective, at the end of July, the market was also pretty high, and we're up 3.8% total from the end of July. And if we count from February of 2018 to the present, it's averaged about a 4.6% rise. So it's really difficult during periods when the market has a lot of up and down, and it does right now. Over the last year to 2 years, we've had a lot of ups and downs, to look and see whether the market has really risen that much from when you invested or when somebody invested or from any given point. Right now, we are a year out from the rather dramatic downturn last year in December. So it's already started last year at this point. So I'm not probably going to say a lot about the 1 year return in the market, because 1 year return in the market is pretty unrealistic. Year to date in 1 year, it's a nice big double digit number, but that's not something you should pay much attention to, because it's a reflection of more how far the market was down a year ago and how much it's, rather than how much it's up from where it has been in the past. 10-year U.S. Treasury note, fell 5 basis points. Now, a basis point is 1/100th of 1%, which doesn't sound like, again, doesn't sound like much until you figure that there's only 1.78 points to work with. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note is paying interest, if you were to buy it on Friday, of 1.78% per year. Again, that is something that needs some perspective on it. A year ago, it was paying over 3%, 3.2. Now it's paying 1.78. What does that mean? You know, we report these numbers every week, and they come out in the newsletter and the column that I do in the Salado Village Voice, and it's there, and it's a number, but what does it mean? In essence, a year ago, the collective wisdom of all the buyers and sellers in the Treasury market, and that's bills, notes, and bonds, in other words, which is a huge market, and there are literally millions of people involved in making these trades. The collective consensus was that somebody should pay, if you're going to loan money to the federal government for 10 years, you should get a 3.2% interest rate just to break even. Now, why do you mean by break even? That means that they expected the growth in the economy to be fast enough over the next 10 years that it would generate about 3% inflation, which is, by the way, the long-term historic average for the market, for inflation in the United States. And they were, since there is virtually zero risk for holding that money for 10 years with the Treasury, they said the only risk that they perceived was that inflation would eat into the value of the dollars they would get back 10 years from now. So they demanded a little over 3% interest from the federal government to leave their money there. Now they're saying 1.78 is plenty. What does that mean? They, in essence, over the next 10 years, the bond market, the Treasury bond market, with some very sophisticated investors in it, is predicting a very slow rate of growth. Now, does that mean it's going to happen? No, because when we look at why it's at that level, we back up to the 5-year point, and we discover that the 5-year is down about 1.6%. And everything from short term, 90 days, all the way out to 5 years is right around 1.6%. What that in essence means, when we look at this carefully, is that the Treasury securities markets and the people that are involved in them are anticipating that sometime in the next year, interest rates are going to be pretty darn low across the board, because the economy is going to be in a slump of some kind, and it isn't going to be particularly pretty. That's what they're predicting, in effect. That's why interest rates are low. Low interest rates mean that there's going to be very little inflation. Inflation is the balance between supply and demand. When there's a lot of demand for a limited amount of goods, the prices go up and we get inflation. When there's a very limited demand for a great amount of goods, There's very little inflation. As a matter of fact, there effectively is no inflation. And if there is a huge amount of goods and no demand, you get deflation, which is why the economists are so afraid of deflation, because once deflation starts, people stop making things. And that, interestingly enough, is what's going on in the economy. The oil market kind of backed up the treasury market this week. It also fell. It was down 4.33%. The price of West Texas Intermediate oil was down 4.33%. And the consensus among the traders that are sampled by the editors and the newsletters and so on was that they're anticipating a glut of oil. And they're anticipating that we have too much oil. Now, did oil production suddenly go up? Nope. Supply did not go up. Matter of fact, supply is backing off just a little bit. Which means, again, the forecast among all of these many, many, many people, many thousands of people who determine the price of oil collectively by their buying and selling of futures contracts is that we're going to have a reduction in demand going forward. Is that backed up by reality? Well, yeah, actually it is. A couple of interesting things came up during the week that kind of back that up. The capital business investment by companies in the S&P 500 only grew 0.8% in the third quarter, in the whole quarter. Now, what does that mean in perspective? It means that the normal growth rate in a quarter is closer to 3% for capital investment in S&P 500 companies. How does that relate to the reality of the economy, and why are we saying, and we are saying, that there's a very high probability of a recession next year? In 2009, when the market bottomed and we kind of, and the economy felt bottomy to us, we saw a surge in capital investment by S&P 500 companies. What's capital investment? That's buying long-term equipment. That's building new buildings. Anything that they purchase, that they invest in an S&P, in a corporation, that is going to last a long time, and they invest in it because they think there will be increased demand in the future, and because they think they'll make more money that way. And sure enough, when we see surges in capital demand across the board in the major corporations, historically the economy has profited dramatically from that, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy to some degree. For example, if a lot of corporations decide simultaneously that they wanted to build new buildings and buy new long-term equipment, well, somebody has got to get out there. Construction companies have got to make those, got to build those buildings, and companies have got to make that equipment. And a lot of that's made in the United States. The construction, of course, is all done in the United States because it's here. That causes more people to be hired and more wages to be paid, which causes more activity in the economy, more trading going on. Trading is people taking their wages and buying things. That's trading. It's not just exchanging things. And that means that the economy will have a tendency to grow going forward. The reverse is true just as well, which is why we track business investment very carefully, which, by the way, has now been down for at least three months. And actually, if we look at it a little differently, 6 months, it's been in a slump. It's been declining. And just like manufacturing has been declining. And what does that mean? That means that corporations are looking down the road, and they're looking at the planned purchases by other people from other corporations from them, and they're looking at the economic circumstances down the road, and they're concerned about the future, and they're in the position now where they have, except for two companies in the S&P 500, they have a negative belief that they will be able to increase their profitability by buying and investing in new things. Because that 0.8% growth in the quarter, in the whole quarter, that 0.8% growth is credited to only two companies. Without those two companies, we would have had a negative growth rate, or we would have had a contraction in business investment in the S&P 500. And that's Amazon and, let's see, who was Apple and Amazon. Apple and Amazon are both investing for future returns, and virtually nobody else is. Amazon is notably takes almost all of their profits. They're barely profitable compared with other companies. But they're barely profitable because they take so much of their free cash flow that otherwise would be profit and turn it around into increasing their market share, increasing their services, buying trucks, buying robots, buying factories. And matter of fact, they're one of the biggest real estate purchasers in the United States today because they're buying up malls as they fail and they're buying up warehouses wherever they can and converting them into distribution centers so they can do next day. And if you're living in a city, same day delivery, which is costing them a lot of money. It's impacting their profits and they're reinvesting tremendously. Apple is running very much the same way. They believe that it's critical that they stay on the cutting edge with their phones and their iPods, not iPods anymore, their AirPods and everything else that they're doing. So they invest a lot of their money back into new technology and new equipment and new construction facilities. You know, and you can see that, for instance, Apple is building a new construction facility in Austin. And it looks like it's going to be a profitable operation, particularly if the tariffs continue to increase, because the president has offered to exclude Apple from the new tariffs that would otherwise hit their phones because they're building a plant in Austin. In other words, by investing that money, Apple is likely to have a higher return. But there's only two companies in the S&P 500 that are doing any serious investing. The rest of them have said, no, we're concerned that we're going to see a slump going into the future, and we don't want to get involved in that. And again, you're listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jeff McClure. Jake's out today. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. So we had some good news in the economy this week. The revised third quarter GDP data was released. Were released. See, data is plural, so it's were released. Let's leave October out for a minute, but the Bureau of Economic Analysis and the Commerce Department releases an initial estimate of the GDP for a quarter, and then they release a second estimate, and then there'll be a third one come along that is theoretically final, but they can update it later on, and they often do. And they bumped up the third quarter gross domestic product of the United States from an annualized rate of 1.9%. It bumped up to 2.1%, which is not insignificant because it means that in the third quarter, the economy grew a little faster than it did in the second. And that really looks positive, and it's led to some people saying, well, maybe we're not headed into a slump. Maybe we're not headed into a recession. But then you look deeper into the reason that they bumped it up, and it's inventories. And again, that's significant. And why is it significant? Because there's a lot of hoarding going on. There's a lot, both at the wholesale level and at the retail level. Companies are buying up things now, generating economic activity, generating profits, generating GDP. Now they were in the third quarter, at least, buying a lot of things in the second and third quarter, more than they anticipated selling in that quarter. They're building up inventory to sell later. Why? Well, because they anticipate prices going up in the future, because they are very concerned about the tariffs. That really is the largest single driving factor in that bump up in the GDP. In other words, by building up this inventory now and by buying something now, they avoid, for instance, the 15 and the 25% tariffs that are still being threatened that could take effect by the middle of December. December 15th is the deadline for the next round of tariffs against Chinese goods, and a 25% tariff on a lot of things coming out of Europe is also in the works to occur this year. If those occur, the prices of things will go up in the future, so it'd be better to buy them now rather than wait. Here's the negative to inventory buildup. At some point, whatever it is they buy needs to be gotten rid of. And when they do that, sure, it'll be sold at retail. Hopefully, it'll be sold at retail. But they won't be buying from the manufacturers anymore. They won't be buying from the suppliers anymore. And the end result is that that will be a negative on the GDP at some point in the future. So inventory buildup, and in this case, 0.3% on an annualized basis, is something that will be paid back later, either in a lower growth rate or in a negative growth rate. Another, by the way, that's another indication in many cases that we're looking at a recession within the next year, is inventory buildup. It isn't a surefire thing. It's not every time we've had inventory buildup that we have a recession in the next year, but it's one of the indicators. Speaking of indicators, and I'm amazed personally that we haven't seen this in the headlines in the financial news. I think people are just kind of ignoring it at this point. For now, 3 months in a row, the index of leading economic indicators has been negative. Now, it's not negative a lot. It went down negative. It was -0.2%, -0.2%, and then this month, -0.1%. And so we got to stay on top of that, because with the 6 month, as of now, the 6 month leading economic indicator is negative. And this is not 100% guarantee that we're going to have a recession in the next year to 18 months, but it is a strong indicator which supports the hypothesis that we have about a 50-50 chance of having a recession next year. And we have a caller on 254-773-1400. John, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Enjoy the show. There was an article in the Wall Street that basically echoes what you're saying. There's going to be a slowdown in the market next year. And they mentioned 8 firms, I think, and even though they universally said there's going to be a slowdown, the percentages or the numbers of the projections were very, very wide. And, you know, big companies now, they all have access to the exact same data. They all have, you know, huge computers to crunch the data. I'm just wondering why the projections are still so wide, even though everybody is analyzing the exact same numbers. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
That's a good question. Why are the economic, when the economic forecasting firms are looking at next year, why are their numbers so different? Now, they're all agreeing we'll have a slowdown. Now, whether we'll have a recession or not remains an iffy thing. A lot of people don't want to see a recession, and there's a lot of assumptions that have to be made. We all have the same data. I have the same data they have. But our judgment about that data is going to be a little different. Let me explain why. We've said this before, but one of the key elements in the economic slowdown, the economic growth slowdown that we're seeing right now, this continual decline in the growth rate, in every, literally every indicator shows a decline in growth rate, whereas some of them, particularly over on the manufacturing side, have already gone negative, where they're not growing, they're contracting at this point. Consumer spending remains high. Really strangely high, as a matter of fact. And there's a lot of, we're in new territory, where there's a lot of things going on here. But there's one big variable, and it is a big one, and that is the trade war. And we've said this before, if the president decided today or tomorrow or whenever that he didn't like the trade war anymore, if he decided he was no longer Mr. Tariff Man, and I want to remind everybody at this point, he said at the beginning of this 2 years ago that trade wars are easy to win. He also said they were quick and it'd be over with shortly. Well, I don't agree with him. History doesn't agree with that. But if he decides to change his mind and gets tired of fighting the trade war and said, we're just basically going to declare victory and remove the tariffs, we'd get a surge in the economy, and we'd get a surge in the stock market, and we'd get a surge across the board, which would delay the onset of a recession probably by about a year. Now, whether it would make the, what it would do to 2021 is basically anybody's guess, but it probably would go a long ways towards preventing a recession in 2020. Personally, I'm of the opinion he isn't going to give up. He's going to continue to fight. The Chinese are going to continue to fight. They may make some show on some relatively insignificant issues. And if they do, that's wonderful. And it will bump us a little bit. So we may have the same data. We have the same data on where we are, but we don't have good data on where we're going to be a year from now. What we can do is look at history, and we can say historically, when we've seen this pattern, here's the results that have occurred. It's kind of like when you see a 50% chance of rain tomorrow. It's very, very similar. The weather, and you see it from several different forecasters. You see one forecaster is predicting 40%, one's predicting 30, one's predicting 60%, another one's predicting 50. They're all looking at the same data. As a matter of fact, if you dig deep into how they do the forecasting, there are models out there. They're computerized models. And the models sometimes disagree rather interestingly about what the weather is going to be tomorrow. And it's finally boils down to the forecaster has to make an educated judgment of what that forecaster thinks is going to happen tomorrow. But many is the time we've had a 50% chance of rain means literally 50%. That means that there's about 1 in 2 chances of having rain tomorrow. Well, right now, the best forecasters, the ones with the best records in the economics world, most recently have been saying 50-50. I think it's a little higher. And some of the better ones do think it's a little higher than that. And why do we think it's a little higher than that? Because there's a lot of cracks showing up in the system. We're going to talk about that today. But that's why the difference in estimates, different models. And then we throw in the fact that we're not in the same world we were in 20 years ago or 30 years ago. The economics world has changed dramatically. It's another thing I want to talk about on the radio program today. The rise of shadow banks. The fact that the Federal Reserve is doing some things in New York with the money supply, with the availability of money. I shouldn't say the money supply because that's too broad a term. But with liquidity in the money market system that they simply never done before outside of a severe recession or a depression. They simply have never had to do that in the top of a market when we have nearly full employment, where everything is humming and running at top speed. And the Federal Reserve is having to inject liquidity into the system to the tune of about $100 billion a week. That effect alone raises questions as to where we are and what's going on. And is disturbing in one sense, in the sense that we've never had to do that before. And in another sense, it's very comforting because the Federal Reserve saw a problem. And they're doing exactly what the Reserve Bank of the United States is supposed to do. They're supposed to be injecting reserves from their system, which are not available to the public, into the system that is available to the public to keep liquidity going and keep interest rates down in the short term. Spiking interest rates in the short term have generated depressions in the history of the United States because there's a critical shortage of money. And when there's a critical shortage of money, people start to short-term interest rates go up, people start to hoard their money, and it produces either a recession or a depression, and the Federal Reserve is busily keeping that from happening. And understanding why that's happening, I've spent a lot of time this week on that. But that's another unknown factor. We've never seen this happen before. Very frankly, we have never seen, other than at the beginning of the Great Depression, we have never seen tariffs used, weaponized, if you will, the way that we're seeing tariffs used today. In the history of the United States, we've never done tariffs on a large scale for strategic activities except right at the beginning of the Great Depression, which was protectionist, but it was a general tariff. And then right before World War II, we were busily enacting tariffs against Japan and Germany, mainly against Japan, and that was from the Japanese point of view, by the way, those tariffs were the equivalent of a declaration of war. From the Chinese point of view, at least based on the literature I see translated coming out of China, the trade war is very much a war. Now, China is not in the position militarily where they can challenge the United States, but if you've been tracking them, and I have, you'll notice that since the trade war started, they have increased their military spending rather dramatically, not because they're planning to invade the United States, but because of a perception in their minds, in their culture, that there is no difference between financial activity and physical war. It is just a difference in perception, and it's a very interesting one, but it basically is similar to the one the Japanese have or had that led to the United States' involvement in World War II when they bombed Pearl Harbor. As far as they were concerned, the attack on Pearl Harbor and on the Philippines was a justified attack based on the fact that we had placed crippling tariffs against Japan as far as importing things from the United States. Now, that's not to say that World War III is about to start. It's certainly not. They went on for many years. The same thing basically happened before World War II in Germany. There were reparations, they were called, but they were in essence tariffs. When one company extracts money from the trade of another country and does so at an unusually high rate, a higher rate than we've seen in the past, the country that is being attacked, the country that is paying the higher rates, is going to be affected economically. And that effect economically is going to make them very unhappy, and it's going to make life miserable for them, and it's a threat to their government. And most other countries, and I would say this including in Europe, consider these activities a form of warfare. And we probably in Western civilization have gotten past that to some degree, but we haven't gotten over it. And these things are all factoring together when economists sit down and try to figure out what's going to happen next year in the United States economy. Well, we actually need to do some commercials. I think we have to. Do we have to do commercials? I'm assured we have to do commercials. So this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and you're certainly welcome to give us a call on the other side of the commercials at 254-773-1400 if today is November 30th, 2019. And we'll be back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach on the other side. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff McClure. Jake is out with the flu. I asked him if he would consider coming in and bringing his flu with him, and he was concerned that he would create a virus infection in the computers and in his dear old dad, so he elected not to, and I don't blame him. And the other thing is his voice sounds really sick. I mean, he sounds like he's sick, and we don't want people sounding sick on the air. Telephone number in here, if today is November 30th, 2019, is 254-773-1400. That's not to say, by the way, that that's not the telephone number if it's not November 30th. It's just that you won't be able to get on this particular radio program because right now we're live, and I guess the opposite of live is dead. So I guess if today is not November 30th, 2019, this is not live. This is dead, which sounds kind of morbid, but that's okay. It's the end of November. It's a good time to be morbid. We've been talking about the capital business investment down. We've actually seen in October, and we talked about in the third quarter, that capital investment only rose for the whole quarter 0.8%. Well, come October, things even got more interesting. The capital investment actually declined 0.7%. So the first month of the fourth quarter, total capital investment in the United States declined by 0.7%. Now, that's an estimate by the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and they may revise it in the future, but we're almost all the way through November, and they've had a month to compile it, so I think it's probably a pretty solid estimate. We're also some other things that have popped up out there. The global trade in that quarter, in September, which is the last date that we have data for global trade, it dropped by 1.3%. More importantly, September's total trade, total global trade, is down 1.1% from where it was a year ago. Now, we take a look at global economics and the fact that the entire globe is headed, pretty clearly headed towards a recession, and some countries in Europe are already in recession. And we say, okay, big deal, that's over there, that has nothing to do with us. But it's important to remember, we're in a global economy. And it's hard to measure how much we are dependent upon the rest of the world for our activity in the United States. We're probably the best case scenario in the world. In other words, we have a consumer-oriented economy where the majority, like between 60 and 70% of the economic activity in the United States comes from us selling things to ourselves in the United States. One, a company in the United States selling some to a consumer in the United States, and the consumer, by definition, does not resell whatever that is, except maybe in a garage sale, and it ceases to exist at that point. So the consumer goes out and works, earns money, then takes that money and buys something from a company, and the company, and when we say buy something from a company, that's just not like cars and washing machines and televisions. When you go out to eat, when you go to the grocery store, you're buying things. That activity is, of the major developed countries in the United States, we have the highest consumer level of activity of any of them, which a lot of people in the past have not liked. They want us to be more manufacturing and export oriented. Germany has a majority of its gross domestic product from exporting. Japan has a majority of its gross domestic product from exporting. China has a big chunk of it. They're trying quickly to reverse that. China is working very hard from their central controlled economy to develop consumer spending. Why? Because they envy, they have U.S. envy, they have consumer envy. Because it's a lot easier to function in a world that is uncertain if you're in the position where you're making things and selling them to your own people. You're not subject to whatever happens outside the United States, which brings me to an interesting little point. There's still some people who want us to go back on the gold standard. And the reason, primary reason that Jake and I object to that, and the reason that economists in general object to it, is because the gold production in the United States is minor. The gold production in the rest of the world is major. The vast majority of gold production in the world and gold pricing in the world is generated by Russia, South Africa, and China and India. So that if we were on the gold standard in the United States, the value of our currency would be subject to whatever those countries did. And that would be similar to the situation that Germany and Japan find themselves in, where their economy is based on how much stuff we buy in the United States or how much stuff is bought someplace else. They don't have an internal ability to generate activity in their economy and buoy up their economy to keep it from going into recession. And the Germans have paid a high price for that, and they're probably paying a price again. They're technically on the edge of recession. They had a GDP in the last quarter of 0.1%, or actually half of that. And so they're technically not in a recession at this point, but they're right on the verge of it. And the reason that they're on the verge of a recession in Germany is because they're so dependent on exports. And I told you that trade, world trade, global trade, has been declining, which means they are exporting less around the world, and because their exports are falling off, it's damaging their economy. The United States officially has about 12% of its gross domestic product generated by exports. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot until you realize that if you pull down our GDP by 12%, that's going to have an effect. But here's where the numbers are a little misleading and why we're so much involved in the global economy. The fact that, let's just say, an automobile manufacturer, and I'm just going to use this generically, is selling cars overseas, and that is an export, that sale of that car outside the United States, it's made in the United States, is an export, or oil is an export, is counted as that 12%. What's not counted is the fact that if the car company is buying parts from other suppliers in the United States to make the car that's sold overseas, that's a piece of the GDP that's not counted as export. So if that 12% of exports dropped off, it wouldn't quite double. It'd probably be closer to 20% of the GDP would disappear. And here's what would happen if that occurred. If all of a sudden we stopped exporting, we no longer had people overseas buying stuff from the United States. It would probably cause a 20% drop in GDP. And let's talk about a 2% GDP. That's a 0.4. That drops us to 1.6, which doesn't sound too terrible, except that there's a lot of people who are dependent upon that export to make a living. John Deere, for example, and Caterpillar export an awful lot of their equipment to the rest of the world. The oil field, and by the way, this is an interesting point, may get into this a little more next hour. We officially, in the month of November, somewhere in the October-November time frame, and there's not a specific date because the reports come in erratically, exported more barrels of oil than we imported for the first time since the 1940s. The United States of America is not just a net exporter of oil. We officially exported more barrels of oil to other countries than we imported from other countries. And you say, well, I heard this happen some time ago. It is bumped a little bit here and there to that where you could technically say that. You could technically say it because a lot of the oil that we import, we run through our refineries and then we send back out as refined products. And that was counting in there. But now, I mean, just at raw numbers, the United States is now the world's largest exporter of oil, which is just mind-boggling for those of us who lived in the 1970s when OPEC cut the oil off. We didn't have anything to do. We're in a really interesting position. We're still importing a lot of oil for a very good reason. We have a lot of refineries in the United States that are designed around the refining of heavy oil products. There's light products and heavy products, depending on what percentage of volatility there is in the oil, how light and gasoline-looking the oil is, as opposed to how heavy and tar-like it is. And the majority of the major refineries along the Gulf Coast, for example, are designed and oriented on processing heavier oil, like the oil from Venezuela and from a lot of other places. And they are not at all good at processing and refining the oil that comes out of fracking, which is relatively light oil. And as a result, in order to keep those refineries functioning and in order to keep the world running, we import a lot of oil just so we can process it and ship it back out again. It's a complex, like a lot of other things, it's a complex situation. But we have crossed a marker. And the marker is that we are now literally exporting more oil than we're importing in the United States of America on a raw, absolute scale. And it is an amazing factor for those of us who've been around for a while. It never ceases to amaze me. Some of you may remember there was a zero oil movement about 20 years ago, a big movement that said peak oil movement that says we have hit the peak production of oil in the world. And we only on a decline from here, and oil will be $1,000 a barrel, and the world will be in a gigantic depression because the price of oil will go so high and be so rare, and we're so dependent on oil to drive around and to deliver things. Everything we do is so dependent upon oil. And here we are today. As a matter of fact, there was a dire prediction back in the 70s when, by the way, there's been a major inflation factor of about 10 since then. So you can basically take whatever price you have today and divide it by 10, and that was the price we were paying for it back in the early 1970s. So that if you pay $3.50 a gallon for gasoline today, it was equivalent to about 35 cents a gallon back then. And at the time, $100 a barrel, which is what was being forecast in the 1970s, when we realize the world is running out of oil, it's running out of ability because we couldn't find any easy oil to pump out of the ground. It was anticipated then that oil by now would be $100 a barrel. Factor in inflation in today's dollars, that would be $1,000 a barrel. Instead, it's 55. And that shows the danger of making long-term projections about economics, because as soon as the price goes up in a free market system, somebody will come up with a way to do more of it more efficiently, more effectively, because the price went up, which is one of the things that our economy runs on. And it's kind of like breathing. You don't think a lot about breathing, but it's there all the time. It's kind of like the air. And we are blessed to be in a situation where we have a relatively free enterprise country, where we have relatively light regulation. It's heavier than it once was, but there's pretty good reason for that. And we generally don't regulate in areas where there's not a consensus that we need to regulate. So we've done this tremendous innovation that has kind of slipped by, that people don't pay much attention to. You just are calm and satisfied with the fact that it costs $3 and something cents a gallon to put a gallon of gasoline in. We don't think about the fact that that effectively makes oil cheaper than it was in the 1970s before the OPEC decided to do an embargo against the United States. And we have, matter of fact, we're in an interesting position where oil is cheap enough that we're having trouble producing it for profit. And it looks like we have another call on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, Jeff. I'm like you. I'm old enough to remember the 70s and the Arab embargo and all that stuff about oil. But makes me wonder, I guess, maybe the majority of the population is not. I know you deal more with economics rather than politics, but I understand that one of Sarah Warren's proposals is to eliminate fracking. And so if you were actually successful at that, I'd like to hear what you'd say about what that would do to the economy and our oil supply and so forth.
Okay, I'll do that.
We're running a little short on time this hour. I may have to boil over to the next hour, but I'll do that. The problem, what she's actually said she would do is by executive order on the first day. If Elizabeth Warren were elected president, she said by executive order on the first day she would ban fracking from public lands. That wouldn't ban all fracking, but it would ban a lot of fracking in a lot of places. It wouldn't touch Texas, by the way, because it's not public land in Texas that the fracking's going on. So it wouldn't be as big an effect. She does not have the right to ban fracking. There's a couple of things, very frankly, without being political, I don't care who's doing it, that really bug me. One is when by executive order the President of the United States does something that traditionally has been, that in the Constitution the Congress is supposed to do. That is dictatorial. That is where Congress has shirked its responsibility. It's passed a law allowing the President to do something that the Constitution allocates to Congress. And it bugs me. It bothers me. Rather than saying, do we have a consensus where the representatives in the House of Representatives would agree with this, so that we have a consensus in the United States is a good idea, or does the President just decide it's a good idea and just do it? That's one of the scary things about Elizabeth Warren, and very frankly, one of the scary things to me about Donald Trump, is all these executive orders. Whereas in the past, presidents have not exercised those except in very unusual circumstances. Is it? And it's just my opinion. It has nothing to do with one way or the other. As far as effect on the United States, if she banned fracking on public lands, it probably would raise the price of oil globally. It would raise the price of oil in the United States, which would probably, if we didn't already have a recession at that point, would trigger one. But here's the good news. The President may have a lot of power and Congress may have a lot of power, but we do have a Constitution. And if artificially the price of oil was run up in the United States, let's just say that there's enough fracking on public land that it would affect the price of oil, then what you would see is what's already going on in Texas, and you would see a lot more wind farms. You'd see a lot more solar panels as entrepreneurs jumped in there and said, yay, here's an opportunity to supply energy at a comfortable cost, because the price of oil went up. Now I can make a money doing this other way, and pretty soon the price of oil will go back down again. It would be short term a problem, and I would prefer to let the markets handle it rather than the President do it by executive order, but it wouldn't be catastrophic. There's a couple of catastrophic things she wants to do. except for the fact that she can't do them without Congress to do it, which is the way our system is set up. And I'd rather not have a dictator who can arbitrarily, for example, shut down all the health care, all the health insurance companies in the United States just because she decides to shut them down. That's the thing that scares me more than anything else. That radical of a change in the economy, very frankly, we don't know what effect that would have. I can tell you with some degree of certainty that we would have unexpected events going on, and I'm vastly prefer on health care that we gradually move in the direction of finding ways to provide health care for a lot of people who don't have it, because we frankly spend way the heck too much money on health care in the United States. We spend roughly twice as much as other countries who have different systems, and we have less good outcomes, and we have some phenomenal profitability in some corporations from it. But it's President Trump's desire to make it more transparent. Well, we're out of time. President Trump's desire to make it more transparent is good. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. This is going to be the end of the first hour. We'll be back next hour with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to contact us off the air, you can contact us at 254-947-1111. We'll be back.